Thanks, Bob. That 139th Psalm is a tremendous piece of work. It's great to be here with you today, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk with you about what the Lord has for us in His Word and is instructive in how we ought to live and how we ought to think. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, our Lord says, "Fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul. But rather, fear him which is able to destroy both body and soul in hell." So I'd like to discuss this concept with you this morning. Fearing God. That's what the Lord is talking about here. God is the only one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Nobody else can do that. He is the one that we are to fear. There's no question biblically but what we are to fear God. The fundamental fact of our existence is our relationship to God as creature to creator. And the basic response that our creator expects from us is fear. It may not be the most important response he expects, but it's the most basic response. It's the original response. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Proverbs 9:10. The reason I'd like to talk with you about this is that the biblical words, Old Testament and New, the biblical words for fear have two main connotations. And as long as I've been around the church, there has been a discussion as to which of these connotations is the right connotation? Or are we supposed to have a combination of these two connotations? There is fear in the sense of being afraid of God. We can call that terror. And there is fear also in the sense of having a respect for God, a reverence or an awe. Both of these are connoted by the words that are used. There is a fear of terror that comes upon us when we've sinned, because it truly is a fearful or terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 31. Given the fact of sin, the fear of terror is a legitimate fear. But this other connotation of fear, the sense of reverence, respect, or awe, has its place as well, it seems. Back in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 3, children are commanded to fear their parents. Now, this surely is not intended in the sense of terror. We don't want little children to be in terror of their parents. There are children who have to be and need to be, and that's an awful thing. God is a God of love. He wouldn't want children to be in terror of their parents. So this surely is in the sense of respect. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 2, this can at least be understood as telling wives to fear their husbands. Again, not in the sense of dread or terror. It's the fear of respect rather than terror. In Isaiah chapter 11, verses 2 and 3, the prophecy is made there that the Messiah would be filled with the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and that he would indeed delight in the fear of the Lord. I don't think this can be construed as terror or dread, because Jesus did not dread his Father. He was not in terror of him, but yet he did reverence his Father. So both of these aspects are legitimate, and it seems that circumstances may change from one application to the other, from one sense to the other. Let me give you an imperfect illustration of this, if I can. If I go into Walmart, and I make a purchase, and I'm carrying that purchase out the door. As I'm on my way out the door, I encounter a police officer. All right, I've just made a legitimate purchase. I encounter this police officer. I'm not afraid of him, though I respect his office. I fear him in that sense. I honor him in that sense. I may greet him. I may hold the door for him. I'm not in any way anxious to get away from him, because I've got no reason to be. On the other hand, if I go into Walmart and I rob one of the cashiers there. And on my way out the door, I encounter the same police officer. Then I am in dread and terror. I am going to be in abject terror because I want to get away from him right now. What's changed from scenario one to scenario two? The police officer hasn't changed. In scenario two, he may not even know what I've done yet. So he's exactly the same. But I have guilty knowledge of what I've done, and I know that he's about to find out what I've done. So I've changed from respect to terror, not because of any change in the authority, but because of a change in me. Peter, in talking about our relationship, says, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. 1 Peter 2:17. In the first scenario, I did that. We're told by the Apostle Paul with regard to civil government that if thou doest that which is evil, be afraid, be very afraid if you do that which is evil. Why? Because he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God to execute wrath. He's a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Romans 13, verse 4. In relation to God, his fearsome and awesome infinity overwhelms us with a sense of awe at the very thought of him. We ought to be in awe of God all the time. We are overwhelmed with our smallness and weakness in the presence of the omnipotent and omnipresent God. We recognize the infinite distance between us and God. Even angelic beings cover their faces in God's presence and cry out, "Holy, holy, holy." Isaiah 6, verses 2 and 3. Jeremiah said, "There is none like thee, O Lord, who would not fear thee, O King of the nations. Indeed, it is thy due." Jeremiah 10, verses 6 and 7. The fear of God is the most essential of human attributes. Again, it may not be the most important of human attributes. Jesus teaches us in Matthew 22, verse 37, to love God, and he says that this is the first and greatest commandment. But the fear of God is foundational. It's the beginning of knowledge and of wisdom. And I'm not convinced that we will ever love God as we should unless we first fear him as we should. The fear of God is key to life. Proverbs 10:27, Proverbs 14:27, Proverbs 19:23. Not going to take the time to read or quote all these. But the fear of the God is the key to life. The fear of God is the key to peace and well-being. Ecclesiastes 8:10 says, "It will be well with those who fear God." Proverbs 15:16 says, "Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil without it." Fear of God is the determinative attitude of the human heart. Fear of God is the characteristic mark of God's people. They are God-fearing people. We don't hear that term as much as we used to, at least not in a serious sense. Sometimes it gets joked about, "I'm going to put the fear of the Lord into you," this type of thing. But it used to be 50 years ago that it was commonly heard that somebody is a God-fearing person, and this was a compliment. And it was a compliment in the Bible, wasn't it? Think of Abraham and Job and Cornelius and others who feared God. This is a good thing. It's the ungodly who are devoid of the fear of God. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Romans 3, verse 18. And this is why they live in the way that they do. This is why they treat one another and treat us the way that they sometimes do. Reverential fear ought to be our natural response to our Creator, but it will not automatically be our natural response without exception. Therefore, fear is commanded by God. Fear of God is commanded by God. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Philippians 2, verse 12. Now that trembling, as indicated there in Philippians 2, does not always have to mean terror. If you think it does, let me point you in the direction of two or three passages that I'll also not take the time to go to. 1 Corinthians 2:3, 2 Corinthians 7:15, Ephesians 6, verse 5. All of these indicate that there can be trembling without terror. So I'm not saying that it necessarily indicates terror all the time when we have trembling, but I will say that an awe that's reverential enough to induce trembling seems to me to be beyond what is commonly meant by reverential awe. And so maybe it winds up somewhere between these two on a continuum. Let me ask you this question. Is it possible for a God-fearing person today to be filled only with reverential awe for God, with never any mixture of terror and dread of God? I believe the answer to that is probably not. Now, ideally, God does not want us to be terrified of Him. We have lots of admonitions in the Bible that say, fear not. But the problem is we have this continuing issue with sin. And the Lord's apostle said, if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. And he's only talking about civil government there. If that's true of civil government, how much more would it be true of the one true and living God when we have erred against Him? Behold, therefore, says Paul, the goodness and severity of God. We've got to look at both of these. Upon them which fell, severity, but toward thee, goodness, if thou continue in his goodness, otherwise thou also shall be cut off. Romans 11:22. So we do need to be afraid, at least at times, because there is this tension in humanity subject to sin. Already this has been referenced a couple times this morning, but I want to go back to it and highlight it for just an instant. You heard Steve, if you were in the auditorium class, read almost the entire first chapter of the book of Revelation. The Apostle John spent years with Jesus. He walked with him, talked with him, ate with him, worked with him for 3.5 years. He was in the inner circle with Peter and James of the apostles. And of all the apostles, John was the disciple whom Jesus loved. In a way, he didn't love the other apostles. But when he turned around on that Isle of Patmos and saw the glorified Christ, John didn't say, hey, how you been, old buddy? Great to see you. No. The response of the Apostle John, as Steve read, when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. That was the response of the Lord's Apostle, the disciple whom Jesus loved. And it better be our response as well. Yes, it's true that the Lord touched him and said, fear not, here's what I want you to go do for me. But that's the same Lord who said, sit in the back, and if they want to honor you, they will invite you up to the front. Similarly, we'd better have an attitude of prostration before God that does not presume too much. We ought to be perpetually amazed that the mighty God of heaven has anything to do with us at all, because we certainly don't deserve it. If we want 2020 vision about the fear of God, we need to look at Exodus 20:20. The reason we do is that that verse contains the word fear twice in an interesting juxtaposition of ideas. In Exodus 20:20, the children of Israel coming up to this time had delighted in the mercy of God. They had come up singing out of the Red Sea. They had followed the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day, but now they were called to face God Himself. Beyond and behind all the superficial aspects of their life, they were called on to really get down to the heart of life. God has pronounced the Ten Commandments with thunder and lightning and trumpeting and smoking, and the people recoiled. The people were afraid. The people moved away from the foot of the mountain, chapter 19, verse 17, to a place afar off, chapter 20, verse 18. And the people pled with Moses to serve as their mediator because they were afraid that God was going to kill them. Let not God speak with us anymore, lest we die, they said. They hid behind a man to keep away from God. And Moses said to the people in Exodus 20:20, fear not, for God is come to prove you, that His fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. What's he saying here? Fear not, because God is trying to get you to fear Him. That's what he's saying. Obviously, there are different senses of the word fear used here. This is an attempt to remove one kind of fear and instill another kind. Do not fear with such a fear as brings consternation and produces nothing but terror. Fear with that fear which reverence and affection inspire, so that you sin not. God is testing his people to reveal whether they will obey him. God is attempting to produce people who fear God in such a way that they do not sin. And the test revealed in their hearts a fear that drove them away from God. It should have produced a fear that drove them closer to God. An awful God, AWE-FULL, fear of God, is what they should have had, that they might be kept back from sin by his mighty power. This included the idea of dread and maybe a touch of terror, because the fear of God includes the fear of judgment. But the right fear of God is more extensive than mere dread. It has that awe, that reverence, that honor, and that worship which constrains adoration and love for God. The fear that the test at Sinai should have produced was modeled by Isaiah in the 6th chapter of Isaiah at his call. Woe is me, for I am undone, chapter 6, verse 5 of Isaiah. But then he said, here am I, Lord, send me, in chapter 6, verse 8. It's a fear not so as to draw back, but a fear so as not to sin. We must not let our religion satisfy us with anything less than God. Don't hide behind the superficialities, even religious superficialities. Insist on having your soul get at God and hear his voice. Like Samuel, our attitude should be, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth. At Sinai, we have man fearing his native element. This was the God from which he sprang. This is the God who created him in the first place, the God that he used to walk with in fellowship in the garden. And now man is fearing that very God. Man was made to talk with God. This is like a fish saying, don't throw me in the water, I might drown. It's denying its native element. God is simply saying here, don't avoid God, seek God. And Moses shows the counterpoint to the people. Just as the people drew back, so Moses drew near to God. Was Moses afraid too? You bet he was. So exceedingly terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake, we're told in Hebrews chapter 12. But the display which drove the people off attracted Moses. Moses even went into the thick darkness. Moses was afraid of God's wrath, but he still drew near to God, because where God was where Moses wanted to be. This shows us that the presence of God, the divine presence, is both attractive and repellent. One man said to Jesus, Lord, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. There were also people who said to the same Jesus, well, they came to him and they besought him that he would depart out of their coast. They'd had enough of him. Why is the presence of God both attractive and repellent? Because God is love and God is power, and wherever God is, he exhibits both qualities. The divine presence at once attracts and repels, at once charms and frightens. The Israelites, invited to draw near to God, declined the offer. Moses, given the same invitation and a witness to the same sights and sounds, draws nearer to God. The same manifestations that repelled the people attracted Moses. Now the demons who have no love believe and they tremble. Men who believe in God and have greatly sinned perhaps cannot help seeing in God mainly a consuming fire. Sinful Adam fled and hid after hearing God's voice in the garden. This is the same Adam that walked with God in fellowship prior to that. In the 119th Psalm, the 120th verse, the writer there says, "My flesh trembles for fear of thee, and I am afraid of thy judgments." When the church beheld the judgment of God upon Ananias and Sapphira, great fear fell upon the church. Acts chapter 5. Great fear fell upon the church. When we consider the judgment of God on sin, it's impossible not to tremble in terror if we're thinking straight. But we must not fear only with the fear that has torment. The fear of the Lord is clean. The mere terror of the Lord drove man from God rather than bringing man to God. These same people at Mount Sinai who were so in terror of God here were within 40 days dancing around their golden calf. The mere terror of God did not bring them or drive them to God. But where love increases, fear changes its character. The dread diminishes, and the awe increases. Love draws us toward God and rejoices that it may go boldly before the throne of grace. But even though we in Christ are completely forgiven and are not under condemnation, it is still appropriate for terror to strike our hearts at the merest thought of falling or falling away. Be not high-minded, says Paul, meaning conceited. Don't be conceited, but fear. This is the Lord's apostle talking. A reverence of God's majesty, a dread of his displeasure, and an obedient regard to his authority over us. This fear will make us circumspect in our Christian walk. The underlying warning of the entire book of Hebrews is, let us therefore fear, lest, a promise being left of us entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. Hebrews 4, verse 1. Willful apostasy carries with it a certain terrifying expectation of judgment. Hebrews 10, 27 and 31. Grateful love should now be our primary motive for serving God. But this does not altogether exclude the fear as an incentive for avoiding sin and doing good. A person who stands in awe of God is also going to stand in awe of his commandments. Terror hates punishment, but reverence hates evil itself. And I think this is an important distinction. Terror hates punishment, but reverence of God hates evil itself, hates the evil that leads to the punishment. If I hate the evil, that's different than just hating the punishment that will come from the evil. Proverbs 8:13 says that the fear of the Lord is to hate evil, to hate the evil itself, not just the punishment that will come from it. By fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil. Proverbs 6, verse 16. So Solomon says, fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole of man. Ecclesiastes 12, 13. We should live our lives perfecting holiness in the fear of God. 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1. And conducting ourselves in fear during our time here on earth. 1 Peter 1, 17. I think of us as a lineman working at the top of a telephone pole. We're working close to a line that's carrying enough electricity to kill us. We know that if we touch it, we die. So we must pay close attention every moment. But if we're protected, we need not shake in fear all day long. We need not shake in terror. Similarly, we need to reverence God all the time. And we need to shake in terror when we are considering doing wrong or when we have done wrong until we rectify that situation. The fear of God in us is that which reflects our comprehension of who God is and what God really is. And it will tolerate nothing less than total commitment to Him. The commandments of God are the concrete expressions to us of God's glory and of God's will. If we are committed to Him in love, we love His commandments too. The fear of God and the love of God are different aspects of our response to Him in the glory of His majesty and His holiness. The fear of God is an attitude that must find its expression in open praise. So we acknowledge God's greatness, and we work to cause others to do the same thing. If I can get my fear of God right, it goes a long way toward helping me live a life that is right. We'll leave this lesson with you and conclude this morning by once more extending the Lord's invitation. The song we're about to sing, number 618, is an invitation within itself. If you are subject to the Lord's invitation in any way, we offer you this invitation, this opportunity to come forward to the front and let us know as we stand together and sing. 618.